The next case is 08-2018, Ohio Grocers Association versus William W. Wilkins, Richard Levin, Tax Commissioner. Attorney General Cordray.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal. In 2005, the General Assembly enacted a comprehensive revision of Ohio's business taxes in an effort both to raise necessary revenues and to improve the competitiveness of our business climate. The centerpiece of this package of reforms was an overhaul of the Ohio franchise tax paid by businesses designed to broaden its base and lower its rate. The new franchise tax, known as the Commercial Activities Tax, or CAT, is paid by all Ohio businesses for the privilege of doing business in the state, and the measuring stick for the tax is based on gross receipts.
Counsel, could you help me with some terms here? You have them defined in your brief. Excise tax, what is it?
An excise tax is a tax that's laid on any of a number of different operations or privileges or the like. It can include franchise taxes, it includes sales taxes.
Is the commercial activities tax an excise tax?
It is, as defined by the case law, Your Honor, but very important to note is that in Article 12 of the Constitution, that specifically authorizes different taxes that the legislature can levy, and it uses the phrase franchise and excise taxes. Then later, when the prohibition, the exemption is laid upon sale and purchase of food, only excise tax is referenced
but
there. And
the CAT tax, the commercial activity tax, is an excise tax.
Correct. However, more importantly, it is the prohibition in the Constitution is on an excise tax, quote, upon the sale or purchase of food. So it is only a specific type of excise tax, a tax upon sales, which is defined in the law as a transactional tax that tracks the language of RC 573902, which is the sales tax levied, quote, on each retail sale. That is, in fact, very clearly from the history of the constitutional prohibition, what was being attacked and what everyone understood at the time and the legislature understood as well.
The commercial activities tax, help me with the definition of a franchise tax. What's that?
A franchise tax is understood to be a tax levied upon the privilege of doing business in the state. In Ohio, that has taken various forms.
And you say the commercial activities tax is a franchise tax?
We think it clearly was intended to be and is in its nature a franchise tax.
It is not self-described as a franchise tax, is it?
The legislature specified in 5751-02 that it is not a transactional tax. But when you look at the operation of the tax, there are a number of things. First of all, it continues forward job creation credits and other business activity types of structure from the franchise tax, some of them specifically allowed to be carried forward from the old franchise tax to the CAT, like net operating losses.
I guess where I get confused on these terms is I always thought of franchise tax as being a corporate franchise tax, and a franchise tax on individuals was heretofore unknown to me. Am I wrong in that perception?
Yeah, let me clarify that, Your Honor, because franchise taxes in Ohio went back to the 19th century, and they were originally imposed on certain specialty industries. There were franchise taxes on public utilities, not limited to corporations, but including sole proprietorships and other types of business operations. There were also franchise taxes levied on foreign insurance companies. Many of those were mutual holding companies. They were not corporations per se. In 1902, the legislature created the first general franchise tax in Ohio, which was levied as the choice of the legislature at the time only on corporations. One of the choices the legislature has made in 2005 was they wanted to broaden the base of that and move beyond simply corporations and include sole proprietorships, partnerships, other types of businesses. That is a choice for the legislature to make, permissible choice. And it broadens the corporate franchise tax to a broader franchise tax that we now know as the CAT. Also, that tax
does it include salaries?
Beg your pardon?
For an individual, does it include your salary?
Well, when I was practicing law before I became a public servant, I paid the CAT as a lawyer practicing. It can be levied on individuals if they are engaged in the privilege of doing business in the state. In particular, the parallel nature is shown by the fact that the CAT is specifically made parallel to and mutually exclusive of continuing franchise taxes on several areas, public utilities, financial institutions, and insurance companies. Again, it is parallel to those and understanding itself as a franchise tax. The other thing is that although it's measured by gross receipts, you cannot know from gross receipts how much tax a company or an individual is going to have to pay. First of all, there's a tiered structure of the tax. The first $1 million of gross receipts, you pay simply a flat $150, regardless of how many transactions you engage in or not. Second, there are the business activity credits and other adjustments that are made before you know how much tax you're going to pay. If you've created or retained jobs, there are credits for that. If you've engaged in certain types of research and development, there are credits for that.
That's all concerned with the application and collection of the tax, but isn't the real issue whether or not this is a tax on the privilege of doing business or whether it is assessed on the sale of food and other commodities? Isn't that really the issue for us?
Absolutely agree with that, Your Honor. And the constitutional prohibition only applies to taxes levied, quote, upon the sale or purchase of food.
But the argument is then made that because it's a tax on the gross receipts, some of those receipts are derived from the sale of food commodities. And therefore, it is a tax on that, though the statute says it's not a transactional tax.
That's the grocer's argument, Your Honor, but it is out of step with more than 100 years of case law from this court that distinguishes between a tax levied on sales or property, many cases involving those particular types, or a tax on the privilege of doing business measured by some measuring stick, which may include some form of property, some form of sales. That was exactly the proposition this court dealt with in Bank One Dayton in 1990. Where a financial institution under the franchise tax applicable to financial institutions argued that holdings that it had, some of its holdings were in federal tax-exempt securities. Those should not be included in computing the base, Bank One argued. However, this court said that it is not a tax on that property, which would have been prohibited by the borrowing spending clause of the U.S. Constitution. It is a tax on the privilege of doing business measured by that, among other things. That exactly precludes the grocer's argument in this case because they're making the same argument. They're saying we engage in many sales. Some of those are sales of food. All of that goes into our gross receipts. Some portion of that should be carved out, and we should only pay tax on the remainder of our gross receipts. That would violate the measuring stick principle, which this court has adhered to going all the way back to Western Union in 1876. There was one wobble by this court in the 1950s. In 1952, the court decided Wren Paper, where it deviated from that principle, allowed some federal securities held to be exempted from the base. 2 years later, in Fifth Third Union Trust, the court overruled Wren Paper, saying that it would lead to absurd results. They had reconsidered, and they went back to the measuring stick doctrine and had adhered to it consistently ever since.
Counsel, one of the things that I've thought of when reading the briefs that have been supplied is that I looked particularly to the history of what the legislature does in reaction to taxes and when there is a tax, and there have been several taxes in the past levied on the sale of foods, and those are immediately dealt with and eliminated. And I see the distinction here being those are taxes that would have been paid by the individual citizen upon that transaction. It would have added to the price, their cost of securing that food. And here, it's not borne by the average citizen to pay this tax. It is a corporate or a business tax that is, again, characterized as for the privilege of doing business in the state of Ohio, and then that measuring stick is obviously gross sales less all the other deductions. What's your comment on that observation as far as relevance?
Couple of comments, Your Honor. First of all, we think that the history of the constitutional provision and how it came about and what effect it has had is compelling in this case. In 1934, the legislature imposed the first sales tax. They had some limited exemptions for, I think, sales of loaf bread and milk, but it was applied against many food transactions as well as all other transactions in the state. Immediately, the proposal was put on the ballot for the people to adopt, which they did in 1936, which is the prohibition that remains in the Constitution of taxes levied upon the sale or purchase of food. After that was enacted, all the discussion in the arguments pro and con, the title of the constitutional amendment itself, were clear that they were referring to the sales tax, that is the tax upon each retail sale made in the state. And the legislature went in and cured the statutes to conform to the Constitution by amending the sales tax statute to prohibit taxes on food. The franchise tax, which preexisted all of this, and the personal property tax, which preexisted all of this, never were understood and were not affected in the least by this prohibit.
In 1934, most groceries were purchased at the corner grocer, who was generally a sole proprietor or partner with his brother. Corporations weren't a big factor in the grocery business in 1934, so if one's looking at history, one might assume there just wasn't much, that wasn't a problem.
Well, I don't know for a fact, Your Honor, that there weren't food sellers who were incorporated at that
time.
Well,
I'm sure there were some, but...
And moreover, the personal property tax, which had long been in existence, never was understood to prohibit purchases they had made of food if it happened to be in their inventory when it was assessed, even though they were going to be selling it for food. What the grocers have sought here is by turning that change in the sales tax, that constitutional prohibition aimed at the sales tax, they seek an exemption from the entirety now of business taxes levied in the state because they don't pay personal property tax anymore.
Well, they wouldn't be the only ones that would be exempt. I read through the exemptions and I saw an interesting one, and that is the folks who crashed our economy, the folks who sell or put together these derivatives exempt from tax altogether. They had a pretty good lobby.
But financial institutions are subject to a separate franchise tax under the Ohio Code.
I understand that.
Yes.
But there's a specific exemption for folks who do put together derivatives.
Yeah. The legislature has within its power to tax and to levy exemptions from the tax. You know, we may or may not agree.
Let
with
me take you to the
policy,
heart of what you're really here for, and that's the Court of Appeals ruled against you. Mm-hmm. And on page 9 of their opinion, Judge McGrath gets right down to what turned their decision. It says, though the appellee suggests the CAT is a franchise tax and is not equivalent to a sales or transactional tax, by its very operation, when applied to gross receipts derived from the sale of food, a transactional tax is precisely what CAT becomes. This is so because the tax is measured solely by the gross receipts and is based on aggregate sales, including those sales from food. I think that's what they turned their decision on.
That's a misapplication of this court's consistent case law going back to Western Union, where the argument was made that you can't tax these messages sent in interstate commerce, and that's a big part of our receipts as calculated for the base of this tax. And the court said, no, we're not taxing those messages. We're taxing your receipts derived from that and other things. It was the Bank One Dayton case, where you had a basket of securities, some of which were prohibited from taxation under federal law, and the court said, no, we're not taxing those securities in violation of federal law. We're imposing a broad tax on your gross receipts, and there are many things that go into that basket, and we aren't going to start taking things out of that basket. It was the Fifth Third Union Trust case, which overruled Wren Paper on that very point. If the court were to deviate from that measuring stick principle here, it would reopen quite a bit of settled case law and would upset all kinds of expectations in terms of what taxes are to be collected or not,
Mr. Cordray, what do you perceive to be the burden of proof of those suggesting that the tax is unconstitutional. What burden do you assess they must meet?
I believe this court has said clear beyond a reasonable doubt for two reasons. First of all, statutes are presumed constitutional. And secondly, exemptions from tax are narrowly construed because of the effect they have on everyone else obliged to pay that tax and not intended by the legislature to bear more than their share of the burden.
Don't we construe those who would seek exemption very narrowly?
I believe so, Your Honor. That's what this court has consistently said, and we believe should be done here as well.
How do we assess that burden in this case? Or what is your assessment of the burden in this case, the way the evidence is presented to us?
I think it indicates that if there's any ambiguity in the court's mind about the proper result here, it should be, the thumb should fall on the scale of the state and the legislative power of the purse being upheld. And again, the constitutional prohibition at issue here, very clearly from its history, both in 1936 and again when the issue was revisited somewhat tangentially with the soda pop tax in 1994, is a transactional tax. The language of the Constitution is mirrored in the language of the sales tax law, 5739.02. That was the only law that was ever adjusted in the wake of those constitutional amendments, and other laws such as the franchise tax, personal property tax, were not affected. And in the wake of the CAT, the sales tax remains on the books and food sales remain exempt. The CAT had no effect on those things whatsoever. It merely replaced the old personal property tax and the corporate franchise tax, which were phased out, with a new broader-based, lower-rate form of franchise tax, which is what's at issue here.
And Mr. Cordray, we have already, we've looked at measurement, the same issue that is here in the Kroger case in 65, and I think it's Lakengren in 75, just because it's measurable in part by net income. And net income, when you're talking about food sellers, may include food sales, does not convert it into the excise tax that is improper to be levied on sales.
Time and again, Your Honor, in many different contexts, except for the one wobble in the 1950s that the court quickly corrected, that has been the case. And it's true, it's an important principle because the court has applied it in the retroactivity clause context, in federal commerce clause context, in borrowing and spending U.S. constitutional context, as well as here. And it would be very unfortunate for the court to deviate from that, would reopen quite a bit of settled tax law. Going back to your question before, Your Honor.
Your red light has been on, Mr. Cordray. If you want to save any time, you probably better sit down.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Gosnell.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The issue today is whether two provisions of the Ohio Constitution that broadly prohibit excise taxes from being levied and collected upon both the sale and the purchase of food have any substantive meaning, or whether they could be easily surpassed by the legislature so long as they describe the tax as a privilege tax. And the object of the tax, food sales, are categorized as a measuring stick. This court should reject the legislature's attempt to circumvent the Constitution and uphold what it's always said, that it is the substance of the tax that matters, not how it is labeled.
Counsel, get to the substance of the tax, if we might. How much is the consumer going to save if we decide that your argument is correct?
Well, we don't know exactly how much the consumer will save, but we do know from the record what the expert said. And the expert said that from an economic perspective, a tax on gross receipts, which is what the CAT is identical to a point of sale, traditional sales tax.
But it isn't for those who don't have gross receipts that would exceed $1 million, is it? Someone who sells $50,000 a month has a gross receipt of $600,000 and they pay a flat tax. And that has nothing to do with the amount of gross receipts they have up to $1 million. Isn't that true?
Yes, under the statute, Your Honor, assuming gross receipts are less than $1 million, I think they play a flat $150 tax.
Well, if an entity has $600,000 or $800,000 or $999,000 in gross receipts, they all pay the same tax and it has nothing to do with the sale.
Yep, Your Honor, the point of the constitutional provisions is to ask what is being taxed. Not the rate that's being attacked.
Well, I think when we phrased it with the Attorney General, it was whether or not it is a privilege to engage in business or whether it is a transactional tax on the purchase or the sale of a commodity of food. And that really is the issue, isn't it?
The issue is not, Your Honor.
How do you characterize the issue?
If we understand the CAT to be a, quote, privileged tax, that doesn't change what substantively is being taxed, which is gross receipts. And two, it doesn't end the legal analysis. While we hear about many cases that talk about the measuring stick principle, we haven't heard anything about this court's decision in 1971, the United Airlines case, in which this court addressed a very similar tax, a tax imposed upon airlines for the privilege of doing air transport in the state of Ohio, and the tax was measured by gross receipts. And the taxpayer said, that's an unconstitutional tax on interstate commerce. And this court said, we can't condemn the tax just because statutorily it is labeled a privilege tax for the privilege of doing business in the state of Ohio. We have to look at the substance of what is being taxed. And the substance of what was being taxed was the fairly apportioned gross receipts to Ohio. The same analysis applies here. The text of the Constitution.
Up until this point, the CAT was passed. Grocers, especially at least ones that were corporations, had a franchise tax, correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And what was the measurement for the franchise tax?
Well, the corporate franchise tax before the CAT was imposed upon either net income or net worth. That was the object of the tax, Your Honor.
Both net income and net worth depended on how much food they sold, did it not?
Only at the most indirectly. And I think this distinction is a distinction that is very important for this court to recognize.
And because that franchise tax included in some form or fashion, directly or indirectly, how much food they sold, but there was never any objection by the grocers to that tax, was there?
There was never an objection because there's a substantive difference.
And if this CAT tax is found unconstitutional, what do the grocers pay for the privilege of doing business in Ohio? What is the measurement of what they pay?
They would continue to pay the commercial activities tax, and they would continue to pay it on gross receipts that aren't exempted by the Constitution.
Okay, so they don't go back to any other franchise tax of before, but their bill is enormously reduced because the bulk of their profit, presumably, is the sale of food.
They would continue to pay the tax until the CAT tax,
presumably the bulk of their net income under the franchise tax was also the sale of food.
Your Honor, substantively and conceptually, taxing net income is very different from taxing a gross receipt. Net income measures profit. How much a business has made.
Well, was that as a result based on food sales for the franchise tax?
It would have been based upon whatever they sold.
I'm asking you, was it on food sales in addition to everything else?
It would at least indirectly relate to food sales in some sense. Certainly, we would concede.
Did they exempt food income from this calculation?
Your Honor, what was being taxed under the prior franchise tax was not sales. That is the distinction that made.
It was profit.
It was profit or net worth. And profit and net worth are very different things than sales. Under the CAT, what's being taxed are gross receipts. When you go to the store, and when I go to the store, and we buy our loaf of bread, the commercial activities tax is imposed upon that loaf of bread, that gross receipt from the loaf of bread.
So, counsel, if your argument is upheld, I come back to my original question. How much am I going to save? How much is a consumer going to save on the purchase of a loaf of bread? That would be the sales transaction that the Constitution prohibits, right? The imposition of a tax on the sale or purchase of a loaf of bread. So how much is the consumer going to save?
We don't know how many pennies exactly the consumer is.
Well, you would know that. You know that in a sale of a pencil or a pack of highlighters where I can highlight the briefs. You know what you're going to save on a transaction. Why would you not know what the consumer knows what they're going to save if this is a tax on a sale transaction of food?
I think what you're getting to, Your Honor, is the notion that the state would propose, which is the text of the Constitution only prohibits point-of-sale taxes, meaning those that show up on the receipt, that we can look at and say, well, that loaf of bread cost me 5.5 cents mm-hmm. more. But the constitutional provisions don't apply solely to point-of-sale transactions. The language is no excise tax, broad tax, which the state concedes would include franchise taxes or privilege taxes, shall be levied or collected upon the sale or purchase of food for human consumption. It would be an odd thing for this court to say that that provision applies to each individual sale when the consumer goes to the store.
Well, why
would it doesn't apply to when we combine all those sales together?
Why would it be odd? Because the term receipts is not in the Constitution. It doesn't say the receipts from the sale of an item of food. It says the sale.
Your Honor,
which is a individual transaction, is it not?
Right. The traditional sales tax, as we understand it, is a tax on the receipt, no less than the commercial activities tax.
It's a tax on the value, isn't it?
It's a tax on the purchase price.
Tax on the value of the sale, 6% or 7%, whatever it is these days.
It is a tax on the purchase price of the good. That's exactly what the gross receipts tax does.
But the gross receipts tax, I guess the issue I'm having with all this economic discussion, which I think maybe is not terribly relevant. I think the legal issue is more important. But we don't really know whether each grocer is going to pass along the tax, assuming that we rule in favor of the state. The grocer can choose to pass along that cost on paper products, can't they? And we don't know that it's going to have any impact at all on the price of food, that there will be a transactional, what would be in essence a tax on the transaction of purchasing a loaf of bread. We don't know that, do we? From the tax, this is the legal incidence versus the economic incidence, as you know. And I want to get into that because I think that's really our issue here is the legal incidence of the tax.
Yeah, Your Honor. The plaintiff's position here is not that the tax is unconstitutional simply because the consumer may or may not ultimately pay higher grocery bills. Certainly, the expert's testimony was it's exactly like a sales tax and would have the same effect. But the point here is not getting hung up on that issue. The legal question is, what is the object of the tax? That is the question. Is the object of the tax something that the Constitution forbids the legislature from taxing?
Well, the object of the tax is to say to grocers like everyone else in business, this is the tax you pay for having the privilege of doing business in Ohio. Now, how is it measured? And we have cases that you cited them, Mr. Cordray cited them, cases which tell us how that franchise tax is measured. And I have a difficult time understanding why gross receipts cannot be the measurement. It seems to me East Ohio Gas is pretty close to this case also. How would you distinguish East Ohio Gas?
Yes, Your Honor.
Facts are different, obviously, but the principle law seems to be the same.
In East Ohio Gas, the issue was the tax, the thing that being taxed, which was gross receipts from the sale of natural gas, whether that was a proper and constitutional thing to be taxed. That wasn't the issue in East Ohio Gas. The issue in East Ohio Gas was whether when the tax commissioner changed the rate during the annual period, whether that was an unconstitutional retroactivity problem. And so the issue for the court was, when did the tax become final? The issue in East Ohio Gas was more related to when did the tax become imposed. And this court specifically said that in an annual tax, that the tax isn't upon gross receipts as they received. The issue in this case isn't the when or even the who is paying the tax. The question is it something that the, is it taxing something that is unconstitutional? The state also makes, relies significantly on the Bank One case, where the issue about whether federal securities could be included in the value for purposes of the franchise tax. This court in Bank One was specifically dealing with a statute passed by Congress. It said, for purposes of the borrowing and supremacy clause, it's okay to include the value of federal securities when it's being imposed pursuant to non-discriminatory state franchise tax. So the issue for this court was the franchise tax satisfied that statutory exemption? And of course it did. The mutual holdings case, Your Honors.
Counsel, I want to take you back to a combination of economics and the law here. First of all, there's been a lot in the briefing about how this is a wonderful tax that's going to stimulate the economy. I think Bruce Johnson suggested it was going to add 43,000 jobs and $2.5 billion to the, there was a study that it was going to do all these wonderful things for the state of Ohio. My recollection is that one of the criticisms of the existing franchise tax was that a lot of the Fortune 500 companies had figured out ways to avoid it and were just paying the minimum. So the purpose of the legislature, in my understanding, was they wanted a broad base because the franchise tax as it existed was falling unevenly. Now, your clients, because they are they operate on low margins and high volume, are complaining, hey, this hit us harder than everybody else. My question, the legal question is, if we agree with you, how is this going to work out for others in the food chain, so to speak? A criticism of the tax is, of the CAT tax has been that it's a pyramiding tax. Let's use the example of milk. Farmer sells the milk to the dairy cooperative. Farmer has to pay the commercial activity tax now. Didn't pay that before. Dairy cooperative has to pay it when they sell it to the processor. The processor then pays it to when they sell it to the grocery chain. So it gets taxed about three times, plus the hauler gets taxed and the person who makes the carton. But it's still a pretty small tax on a gallon of milk. Probably put that all together, you don't get to a penny. If we rule for you, the farmer's cat tax, the dairy farmer, is that gone as well? Is the cooperatives tax gone? Is the so is everybody? My question is: everybody in the food chain on their commercial activities tax say this part of our business, as it relates to my example, milk, we don't pay.
Your Honor, the proposition of law that we propose that this court adopt would simply say that for purposes of the CAT, where the gross receipt is derived from the sale or purchase of a food item for human consumption off the premises of where sold, that gross receipt would not be included in the tax base. And I think the question that you pose, Your Honor, is suggests somehow that the constitutional provision is designed to protect specific taxpayers. It's not.
No, I'm not suggesting that. It's
designed
it's
to protect
food.
It's protect the sales of food
right.
from being used to raise revenue for the state of Ohio and thereby increasing the cost of food for Ohio consumers.
But isn't that food to the consumer? And in Justice Pfeiffer's example, no one in that chain is the end consumer until it is purchased from the grocer, because that's the entity, the consumer, that takes that product off premise in order to consume it.
Yes, Your Honor.
So in essence, based my understanding of his scenario and what you're proposing, the only people that would benefit from the exclusion of a food product would be the grocers and not the milk producer and the milk processor and the bottling plant and everything else.
Your Honor, that only assumes that there's that the end product, that the end price of the good isn't including some of the hidden taxes that have gone up through the chain. The statute specifically allows that the price of the good include an amount to cover the tax. But again, I believe that we're missing the forest for the trees here. The issue is what is being taxed. And to tax a gross receipt is the equivalent of taxing its sale. It's just doing it in the aggregate instead of the specific. An income tax is no less a tax on income because it's based upon the aggregate that a person makes over a particular period of time. And it's no less an income tax because certain exemptions may exist or because it's a tiered rate structure. The thing that's being taxed.
So you're
income.
You are not reading 3C as a transactional prohibition.
If what you mean by transactional, and I think it's what the commissioner means.
Tax upon sale or purchase. The words are upon the sale or purchase of food, which suggests the transaction of the sale, the transaction of the purchase, the direct tax, the penny added to the highlighter or whatever.
Yeah.
The direct tax is prohibited. But you're taking it one step further then.
Right. We're saying that the constitutional provisions are not limited to, quote, point-of-sale taxes, which is essentially what the commissioner is saying, that that's the only thing that the Constitution prohibits. But the language says, shall be levied or collected upon. And it says, upon the sale or purchase of food. Our traditional sales tax is really a purchase tax more than it is a sale.
But levied upon the sale or purchase. There may be situations where, as the chief points out, the money is not, or the tax is not sent to the consumer. We're talking about very small amounts of money that may eventually not be paid by the consumer upon the sale of food or the purchase of food. So wasn't 3C really directed to sales tax on food? And that's what everyone understood it to mean.
A couple points, Your Honor. If the state legislature changed the traditional retail sales tax and said, there is hereby imposed a sales tax on food, and it's imposed upon the seller, and the seller shall pay it. I don't think this court would be persuaded that that tax is now no longer prohibited by the Constitution simply because it is levied, the incidence of the tax is levied on the seller instead of the consumer. Interestingly, the state, the commissioner, and the amici, of course, want to tell this court how much money is being raised by this tax.
That's not our concern
that
here.
That isn't your concern, but it's
that's
the
not
point,
a legal issue, I don't think.
I agree with you, Your Honor, but the point is they know
you,
how
but,
much it's being. They said that the tax is not being collected on the sale of goods, but they can tell you how much they've collected on the sale of goods.
I have a question for you.
Okay, Your Honor. Sorry, Your Honor.
It seems to me that this court has heard your arguments in the past, and my question is, what cases would we need to distinguish or overrule if we were to affirm the Court of Appeals? Is there any, in your opinion?
Yeah, Your Honor, I do not believe any case.
This is a clean slate, in your view. I mean, this is a clean slate.
Well, not only is it a clean slate, but if we look at the actual holdings of all of the cases that the state cites, none of the actual holdings stand for this sweepingly broad measuring stick principle that as long as we call it a privilege tax, measured by something, we don't have to look at the substance of the tax. Again, I would look to East Ohio Gas, where the court analyzed what was the legal issue. The legal issue is, when is the tax imposed and when does it become final? The court didn't just simply rely upon a measuring stick principle. Similarly, in mutual holdings, Your Honor, the question was, is the property of a subsidiary the property of the parent for purposes of the other asset exemption? And this court, again, didn't just rely upon the measuring stick principle, but recognized that substantively, the property of the sub is not the property of the parent. The parent owns the stock of the sub. In Southern Gum, the question was, did the tax amount to a double taxation of property? Because at the time, the franchise tax was on the value of the corporation's issued and outstanding stock. And the court didn't just simply rely upon a measuring stick principle. It's looked at the substance of the tax, and it said, look, the value of this corporation's stock is not its property. The stock is owned by the stockholders. It's their property. So none of the cases need to be overruled. In fact, a decision in favor of the plaintiffs here, Your Honor, would stand squarely with those cases and this court's United Airlines case, and the Supreme Court's case in Complete Auto, where after many, many years of dealing with, well, the state statute, it says it's a privilege tax, and that raises some Commerce Clause concerns, specifically said, look, we're not going to condemn a tax because it's a privilege tax. We're going to look to what it does from a substantive operational perspective.
That sounds like a pretty good summation, Mr. Gosnell.
Thank you, Your Honor. We ask that you affirm the Court of Appeals.
Thank you. Mr. Cordray, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
If I could very quickly, Your Honor, we are standing again, not circumventing, but standing on the language of the Constitution, as you noted, Your Honor, upon the sale or purchase of food, and over 100 years of case law adhering to the measuring stick principle. And while I agree with you, Mr. Chief Justice, that we should not abandon legal incidents for economic effects, let's look at what the effects would be. What we know is small mom and pops that you mentioned would save $150 if this were the grocer's position were accepted. Large agribusiness and food selling corporations would stand to reap millions of dollars in savings apiece. As to the effect on the consumer, as counsel acknowledged, we don't know. And their expert, Mr. Lawson, at SS 13, the supplement to the grocer's brief, second paragraph, made it clear and acknowledged that the effect of not applying this tax could be felt by consumers in part, but also suppliers, employees, owner shareholders. And what the incidence of that would be would vary from one sector to another, from one moment in time to another, and this court would be into the shifting sands of economic effects.
Counsel,
with a transactional counsel, tax.
Can you answer the question that I asked about the chain, the milk chain that Justice Pfeiffer laid out there? Would the farmer be relieved of the CAT tax?
I believe that everyone whose receipts included any portion of food sales, under their theory, would be relieved of the CAT tax by taking all of that out of the base, and if that was all there was, then they would be entirely relieved of it, yes.
Even though the language says for, in essence, consumption off-premises.
Well, that would be the factual question in each case, and it's a factual question this court has grappled with from time to time. But the point is, large portions of an entire industry would be pulled out of the base and they would pay little or no tax. It would have to be made up elsewhere, and it is not what the legislature intended. And others will follow with their challenges, and they're waiting to see the outcome of this case. But the actual incidence for consumers can't be told, but for a transactional tax, it is immediate and clear. For a dollar transaction, I will save 5.5 cents if the sales tax is not applied. Point of sale, and the consumer pays it. And that is known, and that is exactly what the court and the people were dealing with in this constitutional prohibition in 1936, in 1994, and consistently.
That's 30 seconds. Thank you, Mr. Cordray. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.